Les colloques du Collège de France.
Et donc, sans plus tarder, je vais passer la parole à Jack Sasson, que nous sommes vraiment très heureux d'avoir parmi nous aujourd'hui, puisqu'il n'était plus revenu en France depuis la rencontre de 2019. Et donc, il a fait l'effort de franchir plus que l'Atlantique. Depuis Durham, il y a aussi une partie de... Voilà. Et donc... Tu n'as pas de PowerPoint, hein ?
Non.
Voilà. Donc, je te laisse t'installer. Et encore une fois, merci beaucoup.
Alors, merci pour M. Charpin pour m'avoir invité ici. Et aussi à Nelly Ziegler qui m'a donné un très bel accueil à Paris depuis hier. Mais je dois aussi remercier Paris elle-même pour l'accueil très chaleureux qu'elle me donne maintenant. La température. OK, c'est en anglais. Wow. Good morning. Good morning, people.
Good morning.
Wake up. Good. OK. Two aspects of my title require clarification. In this report, the conjunction and is not about commenting on several published assessments of links between Mari and the Bible. Rather, it underlines some of the hurdles that are complicating meaningful attempts to make such comparisons. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Is that okay? Fine. The me in the title marks the point at which my distinctly personal observations on the subject begin. I entered scholarship in the early 60s, so sexagesimally a perfect 60 years ago. Mari spoke to me early, chiefly because, fortunately, its king and courtiers were fluent in French, the language of their editors. By then, sensational reports about their contents had already captivated scholarship and me alike. Bible research, by contrast, did not truly grip me until just before I began teaching at the University of North Carolina a few years later. Admittedly, I had grown up with Biblical Hebrew and its cadences through synagogue Torah reading and via the daily prayers my mother compelled on me, for she was a loyal granddaughter of a Hacham Bashi, the head rabbi in Aleppo, Syria. Long before I seriously engaged the archives of either corpus, I became aware of their conversions, chiefly because they figured in a heated dispute over the historicity of the biblical patriarchs and matriarchs. The debate was broad, but it centered especially on Genesis 14, which reads like a military chronicle of Abraham's victory over a coalition of Eastern powers. The chapters, kings, and nations are named in such exotic language that it seemed to signal authenticity. When interwar discoveries at Alalakh, Ugarit, Nuzi, Mari, and Emar revealed the names of numerous rulers and cities, some New World scholars found compelling evidence for a second millennium setting for Genesis 14. In this setting, a battle broke out across the Atlantic. In the New World stood the American William Foxwell Albright, who treated Genesis as an archive with historical details as reliable as any drawn from the tablets recovered from ancient tales. On this, he sparred persistently and fiercely with Old World adversaries, most notably Martin North. Early tidings from the Mari archives recovered in the 1930s furnished Albright with fresh support for his case. The text placed Hammurabi of Babylon in the Middle Bronze Age and filled the stage with Amorite tribes, for Albright ancestors of Hebrews. Their spoken language was a kind of West Semitic, as was Israel, and their text offered tempting biblical counterparts. The office of Shapitum, covenantal donkey slaughtering, bans on spoils, restriction on census taking, and most strikingly, divination and prophecy. For Albright, Abraham's westward route from a Chaldean Ur seemed so plausibly charted that even André Parot had the patriarch Skirt Mari on his way to the Promised Land. What may not have been sufficiently noticed in those heady days was the tendency to biblicize, that is, to let the published text and selected fragments from Mari encourage a reliance on the Bible to deepen reciprocal understanding of both corpora. Throughout the 1960s, I was captivated by the cosmic confrontation among these giants. Though as a student of Cyrus Gordon, I leaned toward a late bronze setting for the patriarchal age, largely because of the comparable social practices recovered from Manuzi. The 1970s brought an abrupt halt to historicist ventures, including my own. To begin with, North died in 1962, in 68, Albright in 1971. With their passing, enthusiasm for debating the patriarchal age waned. When books a few years later deconstructed the enterprise, rigor mortis had already set in. Since then, a historicity for Israel's Bronze Age is sustained exclusively by religious conservatives. Truth to tell, three factors have conspired to inhibit most historicizing enterprises, and in their wake, to dampen incentives for ferreting out correspondences between Mari and the Hebrew Bible. First, starting in the 1970s, biblical scholarship moved away from historicizing approaches and from standard critical method, embracing an array of newer methodologies. The move was short-lived, for in recent decades, biblical creativity is re-anchored in history, but this time centuries later, in the Achaemenid period or later. Only a Persian king, it is argued, could have inspired a Genesis 14 avatar for Abraham's nemesis, Kedar Laomer of Elam. With the chronological gap between Mari and Persia now stretching to over a millennium, few biblical scholars are motivated to establish meaningful historical linkages. Some have sought to bridge it by appealing to vague concepts like cultural memory or to conservative traditions allegedly enduring intact for centuries. Others have treated biblical references to such Mesopotamian towns as Haran and Nahur as vestiges of patriarchal peregrinations. Second, scholarship on Mari and its culture became more precise in 1978 after Maurice Biraud established the sequence of Zimrilim's year dates, thereby providing a backbone for reconstructing threads and narratives from Mari documents. Since then, under Jean-Marie Durand's supervision, elegantly edited Mari's publication began to flood the field, daring specialists to mine them for useful biblical links. For why relatively few biblical scholars have done so, you might blame their editions in French, an exotic language in North American academia. But the anemic sales figures of my English translation of hundreds of Mari letters might indicate otherwise. Beyond the core Mari equipe, in recent years, even the number of Francophone contributors to comparative research has been modest, not much better among other European scholars. A glance at recent North American professional meeting, SBL, ASOR, and ASPA, it used to be known as AOS, confirmed this discouraging trend. Scanning their 2025 programs, I spotted just one paper among dozens that draws on Mari text to illuminate a biblical narrative, and it was authored by Francophone Daniel Baudy. Moreover, excellent scholars have recently published works discussing divine legitimation of war in the Bible without alluding to Mari's rich evidence on the subject, or they treat the rescue, redemption, and release of captives while overlooking Mari's broad contribution to the theme. I still hope the gorgeous documents from Jean-Marie Durand has published since 2019 on Zimrilim's early years will be used not just to decode the intricate political maneuvers of rulers and their vassals, but also to appreciate the prose in which they were composed, for it comes closest to the style and virtuosity of biblical narratives. They were garrulous, newsy, gossipy, occasionally salacious, but rarely dull. They contain countless nuggets and themes of motifs of the kind that also delighted Hebrew audiences century later. Explaining this literary harmony in texts that differ radically in context and purposes remains a challenge not yet fully met. The third and perhaps the most important factor behind the decline of Mari Bible Connections was the shift in American higher education near the end of the second millennium. When I was a graduate student in the mid-1960s, my Acadian instructor had first trained as Semiticist. Before specializing in cuneiform, they already had a strong command of Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek. As they guided our reading of Akkadian text, they sharpened a point by citing Hebrew cognates, if not also biblical episodes. Recent decades, however, have seen a drift toward an ever narrowing specializations across the field. I do not know how students are trained in Europe and rely on you to enlighten me, but in the United States, it's now possible to practice Assyriology without deciphering the source of or meaning of Bereshit bara Elohim, the first words in Genesis. I have also noticed that some of our most gifted graduates in recent decades have gravitated towards Sumerology, a field that seldom feels obliged to engage biblical texts. The reverse is also true. At American graduate schools and seminaries, one may specialize in the Hebrew Bible without ever needing to identify a cuneiform sign or an Egyptian hieroglyph. Consequently, while North American Assyriologists can access biblical lore through dependable English translations, biblical scholars there cannot research Mari material with at least a fair command of French, if not also Akkadian. Otherwise, they must consult reliable secondary publications. Let me reflect more personally on this point. Three decades ago, Jean-Marie Durand suggested that the adventures and experiences of Mari Condottieri would eventually find validation and echoes in the biblical book of Judges. I took this challenge at heart. In a series of Judges commentary for the Anchor Bible series, I cited dozens of Mari era documents whose themes and motifs reverberate through biblical lore. In the first volume of 2014, I argued that biblical traditions become credible when they place their characters in realistic social and military settings. I illustrated this with finely nuanced portrayals of adventurers. In Mari, Samsi Erach of Yapturum and Ibal Addu of Ashlaka. In the Bible, Abimelech of Shechem and Jephthah of Gilead. I showed how the exchanges of daughters among elite can illuminate biblical anecdotes, how Mari's nuanced perception of kingship can credibly track Israel's steps toward that institution, and how a war declaration from Yamchad is essentially replicated in Jephthah's ultimatum to the Ammonites. In the second volume of 2025, I expanded on shared themes such as the hazard of entering a foreign town and the gruesome dismemberment of women into 12 parts. The few reviews of the 2014 volume dismissed these efforts as a scholar's gratuitous insertion of material from his own specialties. I expect much the same for its 2025 companion. Enough of the Jeremiads. Let me conclude constructively by harking back to the series of Revue d'Assyriologie articles that emerged from a 1997 Paris colloquium that engaged the theme of my present paper. In my view, that event remains the most comprehensive exploration of my subject since the late Abraham Malamat assembled relevant issues in his 1989 volume, Mari and the Bible. Several contributors to the Paris Forum belong to a new generation of editor who brought forward fresh materials and incisive analysis of Mari institutions, including Nellie Ziegler on the royal harems, Sophie Lafont on the status of foreigners, Michael Guichard on ritualized warfare, and Bertrand Lafont on blood sacrifices. A paper by our host, Dominique Charpin, memorably brought Mari's troops into the Bekaa Valley of present-day Lebanon. Several of these topics continue to attract biblical scholars, though with less focus, coherence, and regularity than they deserve. Yet too many remain neglected, including diplomacy and statecraft, land distribution, royal panegyrics, menhir, matzebot, and their erection, gala and funerary banqueting, table etiquette, water ordeals, spying techniques, and the insertions of metaphors, similes, proverbs, theosophy, theodicy, as well as reflections on life and death. Let it be clear, however, with the channel of transmission across vast centuries still obscure, we are not affirming biblical historicity when we chart correspondences between Mari and biblical traditions. Rather, we are exploring analogous cultural responses wherever circumstances, contexts, or practices are plausibly comparable. In other words, we turn to Mari to illustrate biblical moments, not to endorse them as history. The remaining presentation of the Paris Forum explored several subjects, including two that remain central to biblical scholarship and have provoked an avalanche of publications in the last few years: prophecy and tribal pedigrees. Building on Jean-Marie Durand's 1988 major edition and renewed examination of Mari dossiers on divinations, prophecies, and dreams, André Lemaire highlighted their principal elements: messengers, messages, recipients, intermediaries, mode of transmission, and reaction from those addressed. He also drew perceptive connection with biblical context. Since then, a string of scholars has continued to explore comparative accounts of the phenomena in both corpora. Yet while biblical prophecy can be debated endlessly through its acceptable manifestation in the Hebrew Bible, without close engagement with Mari's political and social world, it is scarcely possible to unlock the conditions that incited their production. The Mari example are closely tied to specific historical moments. They were transmitted through diverse intermediaries, and in archives, they were aimed almost exclusively at one highly perceptive king, Zimri-Lim. Despite resorting to hepatoscopy to control their validity, their potential to unsettle or influence royal authority could be high, which in turn encouraged self-interested mediations. In one case, an ambitious diplomat, Nursin, appears to have fashioned a prophecy by combining fragments from other sources he was channeling. In another, a queen, Shiptu, tests an ingenious method of eliciting advice that would please an anxious king. The Mari material serves comparative research best when illuminating narratives in the biblical historical books, with their vivid anecdotes of prophets confronting kings, with lectures they would rather not hear. It has proven less insightful, however, when applied to the analysis of the major Hebrew prophets, largely because over time their message grew wordier, more transcendent, universalistic, hortative, and preachy, rarely matching the forms or aims of their Mari counterparts. Tribal matters. I turn last to three presentations by Jean-Marie Durand, Daniel Fleming, and myself, which focused on the Amorites, Amurru in Akkadian, and their possible connection with the Amorim of biblical tradition. Here is a rundown on several issues. In Mari, Amurru refers to a god, the west as a cardinal direction, a language, and a broad term for several tribes and sub-tribes not always united by asabiyya, social solidarity. In Israel, the Amorim are grouped among otherwise unattested nations that occupied the land promised but not yet fully possessed, such as the Perizzites, Girgashites, and the Hivites. They are often confused with the Canaanites. No archaeological remains have yet been recovered for either of these terms. In Mari, tribes, in Mari, the Amorites were nomadic pastoralists who periodically settled and farmed land assigned to them. Their leaders paid tribute to regional kings as often as they fought against them. In scripture, the Amorim are portrayed as gigantic in size, as were the mythical Anakim, Zuzim, Rephaim, and Zumzumim. Their kings slept on enormous beds of iron. Nonetheless, the Hebrew God had them bite the dust. In Mari, the Amorites included two major tribes, the Yamanite, those on the right, hence southerners, and the Simalite, those on the left, hence northerners. Mari was ruled mostly by the Simalites, who married Yamanites but periodically warred against them. In Israel, Benjamin, also meaning southerners, was the smallest Hebrew tribe. Internecine wars nearly destroyed it, but it survived to produce Israel's first king, Saul, one of my favorite characters. Provisionally, both Amorites and Hebrew are classified linguistically as West Semitic. In personal name, they share vocabulary and verbal constructions, yet comparing them can be deceptive. The Amorite system is preserved in cuneiform syllabic script. The Hebrew text in our Bible is artificial, produced by the Masoretes, scholarly scribes around 1400 years ago, who imposed their own Mishnaic Hebrew grammar on consonants produced over a millennium earlier. As a result, they invented verbal forms such as the Nifal and the Piel imperfect that would not have existed in biblical Israel. The Amorites of Mari archive disappear from historical record by the end of the second millennium. A remnant might be connected to a short-lived kingdom in the late Bronze Age. The Simalites and Yamanites occulted even earlier. Despite the vast territory they once controlled on either side of the Euphrates, in the Bible, despite the vast territory they once controlled on either side of the Euphrates. In the Bible, Solomon enslaved the Amorim, but their lore endured into highly decorated Midrashic literature. Still, with the names Amurru and Amorim too phonetically similar to be coincidental, how to promote a historical linkage between the Amorite in Hebrew, the Amorites of Mari and the Bible remains a major burden for biblical scholars. I have no solution, but I will footnote a nice bibliography for those who do. I find it easier, however, to doubt ethnic continuity between the Mari Yamanite and Israel Benjamin, since a tribal name based on human anatomy or a cardinal point is not unique. By that name exists an 11-tribe Arab confederation, even today, that moved north into Syria after the Umayyad conquest. We also have Yemen at the western tip of the Arabian Peninsula. Still, I keep in mind that what my beloved mentor Michael Astur taught me during my graduate days, a subtribe of the Yamanite was called Yarihu, and it had settled by the Jordan River, naming a famous town after itself in Hebrew, Yeriho, Jericho. He also offered explanations for other subtribes, including the Amnanus. Who knows if he was wrong? Let me close by returning to the phrase, and me, in the title. Over my careers, I have followed major archival discoveries relevant to the Bible, including those at Hattusha, Nuzi, Ugarit, Emar, Sultan Tepe, Alalah, and Ebra. Interest in their exploitation often flourished for a time, then faded, especially when archives were exhausted, publications slowed, or attention drifted elsewhere. Happily, the Mari archives still contain many unpublished texts, and new scholars continue to join veterans in publishing them. The hope is that inquisitive biblical scholars will overcome the obstacle to their study and open fruitful paths for illuminating biblical tradition. Setu, thank you very much.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.